This week I want to follow up and take a next step. It doesn't require necessarily the previous sermon to understand. It simply was a series that was built one on the other. Last week I addressed the meaning of the symbols in the first six verses of Revelation 12. Now in that very short passage we see that Satan and a third of the angels were shown to have rebelled against God and were cast down to the earth. And Satan was also shown to have been the mentoring force behind successive world ruling kingdoms, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and finally Rome. Each kingdom greater than the one before that. But Satan, again, the driving force behind those systems. In that same short passage, Satan was shown to have attacked Jesus Christ, ultimately the church, and the church fled into the wilderness for 1,260 years. Now, all of that was covered symbolically in one 3-inch column of Bible text. Symbols in the Bible make for very powerful illustrations. In that chapter, Revelation 12, Satan was portrayed as a fiery red dragon. Now in chapter 13, we see a relationship to that, although it is not exactly the same. In chapter 13 of Revelation, he is shown to rule over a great and fearsome beast. It's a wild beast. Even the Greek shows that it's not just an animal. It's just not an animal in the woods. It's a wild animal. It's an animal like a bear or like a lion or like a leopard. Reader's Digest, almost every issue, it seems, has a bear story of somebody who was backpacking or hiking. And if all I did was read Reader's Digest, I would never leave the city limits of this city, assuming that waiting out there in the bushes for me is my personal bear attack. Because I read those stories and how the people lay there and the bear kind of rends at them and they have to play dead and the bear bites out a few chunks of their important parts of the body and hauls them away. And it's horrible and tragic. And I'll bet you I've read 20 over the years out of Reader's Digest. They have a special column, Wild Bear Stories, I think. But that's the portrayal of the beast in Revelation 13. It's a beast that rends and tears, that is violent and just incredibly mean and severe in its approach. And again, that's what the Greek also portrays. The beast in Revelation 13 is a world-ruling wild animal of a kingdom. But it's also the man at the head of that kingdom, a man who acts like a wild beast, a man who is ultimately going to be thrown in the lake of fire, as is shown in Revelation 19. I wanted to find a way to illustrate to you what that would be like. I wanted to read to you something that would make that a little more clear as to what we're faced with in this world and the times and the years now that come. Adolf Hitler was a man such as that beast. And because that goes back a long ways and we haven't all studied what his life was like and even indeed what some of the details of World War II were, we sometimes don't realize just how terrible that really was. Some of you obviously lived through that time and watched it transpire. Many of us, myself included, came along later and it was history to us before we were even born. I'd like to share with you a little bit of a book that I read, The Life and Death of Adolf Hitler. It's the kind of book where you sit up at night and read it and get depressed. It's the kind of book you start to read it and you can't hardly put it down. When you finally go to bed, you're tired, you wake up in the morning and you feel a sadness, literally a depression that would carry on through me part of the day. And through the day, I'd begin to feel better and better, and then I'd sit down, unfortunately, again that next night with that book and I'd read through some of the carnage and the tragedy that was there. It was just unbelievable. I sat up again with it last night, reading through the book and reading through some of the sieges and the war and some of the way Hitler responded. And so I want to share some of that with you, not to depress you so much, but to maybe bring to life what Revelation 13 is trying to portray and what it's going to be like. I'm going to read you just a few pages or parts of pages out of the book to try again, give you a taste of that. It says, "The rise of Adolf Hitler to supreme power is one of those events in world history which are almost totally inexplicable in any rational terms. The improbable adventurer who conquered the German people by the sheer force of his will and then armed them and set out to conquer the world was an unlikely candidate for the mantle of Napoleon or Alexander the Great, yet he conquered vaster areas than they ever conquered and left on world history claw marks. interesting the way the author portrayed Hitler as having left claw marks on world history, like a wild beast. Claw marks so deep that it is unlikely that the wounds will be healed even for centuries to come. He was one of those rare men who from time to time emerged from obscurity to shake the world to its foundations. He erupted like a force of nature, or tornado, or hurricane, destroying everything in his path, and even now, though the evidence of his destructive fury lies all around us, it seems unbelievable that a single man should have caused such havoc. What he sought to do, what he nearly succeeded in doing, was to dominate the entire world and reshape it to his own desires as though the world had been created for his pleasure. Do you know how many people on this world died because Adolf Hitler lived? 40 million. 40 million people died because of his call for supremacy. That's unbelievable. It's beyond scale of what we sometimes portray or even remember. He walked, as he said, with the certainty of a sleepwalker. He had no doubts about himself in that sense. He walked without questioning even what he believed, and no one ever doubted his self-assurance. While many saw from the beginning that he was engaged in a strange traffic of dreams and nightmares, that he was himself aware of the demonic nature of his gifts, and sometimes he would exert himself sufficiently to attempt to understand them without ever coming to a satisfactory conclusion. The author just says, look, he had demonic power. He had a spiritual power and presence that went beyond the physical to account for what he was able to accomplish and do. He was a law unto himself and unlike other men. Very early in his life, he saw that he was alienated from other men, shared few of their enjoyments and ambitions, and could dispense with their company. He lived alone, cherished his loneliness and his singularity, and reached out to other men only when he needed to use them. There was a madness in him almost from the beginning. His mind was a distorted mirror in which he saw himself as a vast imperial figure overshadowing the world, the supreme judge and executioner, the destined master who had come to cleanse the world of its iniquities. His ferocious hatred fed on mythology, which he only half believed, and he had no deep affection for the Germans. Can you imagine the man that led Germany to world power had no real deep affection or love for the Germans either? His goals were personal. The Germans became his willing instruments of his self-serving will to power. In his dreams, he saw himself as one marked by destiny, protected by divine providence, but destiny and providence have their own mythology. And it says, again, because he lived, 40 million people died, most of them in agony. And as though this were not enough, he spent his last days giving orders for the destruction of Germany. He tried to actually destroy Germany in the end so that they could not live on because they had failed to attain his purpose. And he turned his fury on the nation itself, devoutly hoping that no Germans would be left alive to mourn over their defeats. They are not worthy of me, he said. Such was his ultimate verdict on the people who had obeyed him as blindly as the children obeyed the Pied Piper of Hamelin. I was reading last night about the siege in Stalingrad and how Hitler sent an army of 300,000 men in there to take that city and to hold it at all costs. And because of the way the battle was fought, they were able to easily take the city, but then to hold it, they had to withstand all of the forces that then encircled them. And the general of the troops requested to retreat, to be able to shore up his supply lines, and to be able to reestablish his contact with the other armies on that frontier. And Hitler refused him. 300,000 men in an army in one battle. You know how many United States killed in action there were in World War II? In all of the war, our entire nation, in the whole theater, we had 250,000 men killed in action, and maybe some women, however the count was taken. But our count, 250,000. After the Battle of Stalingrad, when Germany refused, or when Hitler refused his troops to retreat, or was unable to resupply them and refused to let them to surrender, everyone, I think, 120,000 died in the battle, which means they basically starved and froze to death. 180,000 went into captivity of the Russians. After World War II, they were able to account for 6,000 people still remaining of the 300,000 that were there. In one battle, Germany lost more people than our entire nation did in the whole course of the war. Hitler was so angry when they finally capitulated that he ranted and raved that they should have each taken their final bullet and lined up and committed suicide together, that they did not deserve to go into captivity, and that the only honorable thing they could have done is to die in place, a death that he condemned them to. It was played over and over again in the course of the war in many different ways. He was an unbelievably brutal and vicious beast of a man. What Hitler was committed to was his own rage, his own destructive fury. He destroyed first those for whom he had a residue of affection for, those who were most like him and therefore the most easily recognizable. You go through that book and you'll show that there were people that helped Hitler on early in life. They provided for him. They put him up in their homes. Those were the first people that he killed when he came to power. Anyone who had helped him or befriended him or in some way that he felt he owed a debt of gratitude to, he killed them first. Many of those who helped him rise to power, he executed when he was in power. And it was a case that carried on and on again. He drove his own niece, who was his mistress, to suicide, and he killed the Jews because they helped him when he was poor, and because they served as the most easily available channel for his destructive energies. He killed Ernst Röhm and Gregor Strasser because it was intolerable that they should remain alive to remind him that he had depended on them. Individuals who had helped him and befriended him, he killed them first. Thereafter, killing became a habit, and he drew the logical conclusion there was nothing to prevent him from killing everyone within reach. He told his generals as they moved out onto the Operation Barbarossa, as they moved into the Russian frontier, that he wanted total war, a war of annihilation. He did not want prisoners taken. He wanted everyone executed. He wanted everyone killed. He wanted total destruction and annihilation, is the instructions he gave to his men. And anyone who did not abide by that, he threatened with death and execution as well. The rise to power of Hitler and his final downfall constitute the most crucial and mystifying event of this century. Other dictators arose, but there was some semblance of logic in their decisions. They knew what they were doing. At least they attempted to justify what they were doing. They never saw themselves as sleepwalkers, and they attempted to do some good, at least in their own light, according to their own belief. Hitler, beyond good or evil, employed power to pursue his own private fantasies and compelled the Germans to act out his dreams and nightmares. The mystery is how he succeeded in transforming the Germans into his willing victims and why they were so eager to march to their doom. If it can happen once, it can happen again. You have, in our own historical records, a man who appears to be possessed of Satan, who rose to power as a beast domineering a world power, ruling over other nations, and you have now public record of what that was like. Hitler came to power with the help of his stormtroopers, his private armies. They started out by threats. They started out with fists and gun butts, but they finished out by summary execution. As he gained power, then the force by which he asserted himself intensified as well. He demanded absolute unconditional obedience. It became part of the military oath. There was no room for conscience. There was no room for nationalism. It was his nationalism and his personal values that ruled the day. He cowed both the generals and the politicians. He lied, he cajoled, he cried, he threatened. He did whatever it took to get his way at the time. Time after time, I've read accounts that Hitler's own voice and his stare, his own presence, was unbelievably intimidating and yet compelling. That there was something there about him that just made you willing to submit to him or to go along, or that cowed you from opposing him in his presence. It was as if he was your master, whether you liked it or not. Austria and Czechoslovakia submitted to him without so much as a fight, simply turned their nations over to him because of his threats and the propaganda that ensued. There was a man in the church in Roswell when I was there, Michelle and I were there, and we were discussing this issue, and we were discussing World War II, and he says, you know, I have a friend of mine, a personal friend who was a pilot in World War II, and he was in a concentration camp in Germany during the war. He was shot down and captured. And he said, in the course of being in that camp one night, There was a large rally, a gathering of some kind that was set up off to the side of where the camp was, and they had on there some loudspeakers and things, or however that was broadcast back then. And he said you could hear this booming voice floating over across to the camp, and it was German, and it was Adolf Hitler. It was a man, a friend of his, that lived right there in that town, who said he was in a concentration camp, well, a prisoner of war camp, in Germany as a pilot. And he said he sat there at the fence and he listened to the voice, the tone of the voice. He couldn't even understand what was being said, but he said it was compelling. And he told his friend, this man who's in the Church of United there, he said, you know, he says, if I would have been there, a German, he says, I think I would have followed him too. Just, he said, it was unbelievable, the presence, the compelling presence of his voice. And all he heard it was in a language he didn't understand, floating across the open space. A remarkable thing to have somebody from the United States who was fighting against the German army and against Hitler at that time to even claim. Toward the end of the introduction of this book, it says, this is the biography of a strange, wayward, terrified man who nearly succeeded in conquering the world and once called himself the hardest man that had ever been, and he lived up to his own description of himself. Again, a remarkable thing that took place. Adolf Hitler was a wild beast at the head of a powerful military state, and 40 million people died as a result. It was the worst time this world had ever known up until then, and yet the beast power has still to rise again. Notice Daniel 12, and this, you know, this really does, I think, make it very graphic when you understand, when you go back and are reminded as to what took place and how bad it really was and how unbelievable it was, and the camps and the death camps and the suffering and the misery. Daniel 12, verse 1 says, at that time Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. There shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. Prior to Christ's return, there will be a time of trouble that will be the worst time that there ever was, which means that World War II doesn't count as the record, and the Russian front isn't the record, and the concentration camps in Poland and in Germany are not the record, and all the suffering of those 40 million people who died, not counting those who suffered and didn't die, worse than that. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. So when we look at Revelation 13, and it talks about a beast rising out of the sea that is a world power that is going to bring on this earth the worst time of suffering that has ever taken place, if I could, I would read to you those graphic things to help you portray that. I can say, I read them at night, I go to bed depressed, I wake up depressed, you have to shake it off just to read about it. What's it going to be like when people have to live it again, when they have to face it again? Revelation 12, as I addressed last week in my sermon, showed that Satan was portrayed here as a dragon, in that sense a type of a beast. In Revelation 13, there is also a beast that arises. Both the dragon here, portraying Satan in Revelation 12, and the beast in Revelation 13, both have 7 heads and 10 horns, and yet they are not exactly the same. In Revelation 12, the dragon pictures Satan and the succession of kingdoms over which he ruled, while the beast in Revelation 13 pictures the Roman Empire itself. Notice the crowns in Revelation 12 are on the heads, and the crowns in Revelation 13 are on the individual horns. And again, without being able to go back and go through and build each case, I'll address some of that. Let's go back and at least read the first two verses now of Revelation 13. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, on its horns 10 crowns, and on its heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And so we have here a composite a blending. This beast is going to make war with God's people. God's people are going to suffer greatly. Verse number 6. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwelled in heaven, and it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation, a world-ruling power. You know what it means to blaspheme? It means to speak of God or something sacred in an irreverent or an impious manner. To speak irreverently or impiously in that sense of God or something that is sacred to God. Something that God has made holy. You can blaspheme the Sabbath by speaking irreverently against it because God says Sabbath is holy. He's made it so by his own presence. Reverence denotes respect, and piety denotes compliance and obedience to God's word. Again, you take blaspheme, it says it means to be irreverent or impious. You take reverence, that means respect, and piety denotes compliance and obedience to God's word, to his law. So to be irreverent and impious is to be disrespectful both to God and to his word and to his law, to his record. So you see what the character of the beast really is. If we go back to the book of Daniel, you can see what Revelation 13 is built on. You can see the record here of these animals in beast form, again, coming up out of the sea, Daniel 7. Let me read you that as a basis here as well. Obviously, our services today are not going to go our hour and a half. By the time we had our announcements and I had a chance to share with you the conference and carry through this, we'll probably have a full two-hour service today, and so I just mentioned that to you. Besides, I lost my watch. I didn't lose it. My watch broke. Got me another watch. It broke. Got me another watch. Had to take it, send it back to the factory. So even though there's a clock on the wall, it doesn't mean anything because I don't have anything up here that I can really focus on. So I might go a little bit beyond today, but we'll make that the exception, not the rule. Daniel 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions on his head, visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and he told the main facts. And Daniel said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. Now you see, Revelation 13 is a composite beast. These are individual beasts. These beasts portray that succession of empires. Daniel 13 portrays that empire that makes war with the saints. Obviously, that is the Roman Empire. And it exists of elements of those previous empires as well, but it just simply portrays it as a succession of rule through the Roman Empire as compared to a succession of empires leading up to it. First was like a lion, had eagle's wings. Suddenly another beast, verse 5, a second like a bear was raised up on one side, had three ribs in its mouth. And it said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh, rend and tear, do damage and destruction. After this there was another, a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird, and the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. This is the beast now that is portrayed as a combination in Revelation 13. Exceedingly strong, incredibly terrible, worse than the rest. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So again, you see the beast with the 10 horns and where the succession of that, as I show you, will lie. Daniel 7, verse 19. Then I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, unbelievably evil and sinister, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with its feet, and about the 10 horns that were on its head, and about the other horn which came up. See, there was another horn that came up and existed in addition to the 10. One of the verses says it came up in their midst. Another one says it came up after them. But it means in addition to those 10, there was another horn which represents something significant as well. It says, the horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. I was watching, and begins to focus in on the little horn now, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. So understand, when we go to Revelation and we have a beast now that's prevailing against the saints, we have two things here. We have a power, a world power, but we have a horn. We have some other power that is mixed with that. If we were to go back and look here in verse 15, gone by a little bit, we can build the basis a little stronger. I probably should have started here to begin with because it mentions these kingdoms portrayed by the beast. It says, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. And I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all this. And he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Those great beasts which are four are four kings which arise out of the earth. And the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever. So when you put these beasts in order, at the completion of their reign and rule on this earth, then the saints are going to obtain the kingdom. And so we're talking about a succession that will go right up until, indeed, the time of the end, Christ's return. Back with this little horn, we see that it is not just an empire in and of itself that is doing these things. It is coming after and attacking the saints, the people of God. We see here a power that joins with that beast to exercise that authority as well. Verse 21, and I was watching, the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it and break it in pieces. The ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall arise after them. The earlier verse, I think it is verse number 8, says, with them, among them, in addition to them, there is another horn. He shall be different from the first, and shall subdue three kings. It says, and he shall speak pompous words against the Most High. Now, this is the little horn now. The power, the civil power, the military power is indeed the beast. But you see, Revelation 17 talks about a woman who rides the beast. Daniel talks about a horn, an additional horn that goes out and persecutes God's people, his saints. And that's what this is portraying here, this additional horn, the woman indeed who rides the beast. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and the law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. So there's a period, prophetically, as we would understand, of 3.5 years where it says the saints were going to be given into his hand. That's a frightful and a fearful thing. What does it mean to change times? To change times and the law? You know, we might think that over the years we had a little bit of an in-house interpretation of that, because what we believed was criticized and mocked and put down and discredited. And you might think that what we thought about that was just something that we believed and that it really wasn't understood by anyone else. I have the Expositor's Bible Commentary as one of my source books on my shelf or my library at home. Verse 25, I'd like to read you the commentary from Expositor's Bible Commentary that is in here. It says, the little horn will claim divine honors even as he blasphemes the one true God. He will abandon all pretense of permitting freedom of religion and will actually revile Yahweh, the Lord of heaven and earth, and will denounce as fools and rebels those who still retain biblical convictions. By cruel and systematic pressure, he will oppress. And it makes a comment on the word here, oppress, in Daniel 25, 7:25. He says the word here, oppress, means to wear away or to wear out as friction. In other words, he wears down God's people. He wears them out. He exhausts them. That's the kind of oppression that is being addressed. It's the way friction wears away our clothes and our shoes. They just slowly wear out by continual friction against the surface. Such continual and protracted persecution far more effectively breaks the human spirit than the single movement of crisis that calls for heroic decision. You know, when it came time to stand up for what we believed, it was easy, we stood up. But it's much harder to live what we believe than it is to just stand up and make a call. It's easy to stand up and walk out. But every minute and every hour and every day, in relationships, in the way we treat each other, in the way we think about each other, in the way we work together, in the way we support each other, in the way we meet each other's needs, now that's different. And that's a battle. Apologize for some of the pauses to those on transmission. My throat's a little scratchy today, and I'm taking sips of water from time to time. When I did that in Kennewick, people in Spokane thought I had quit or given up or went home or something, and then I'd come back on and speak again. So, taking short water breaks. It is easier to die for the Lord than to live for Him under constant harassment and strain. It's easier to die for God than to be burdened, as some processed, by the obligation to maintain your Christian living on a day-to-day basis. As many a German Christian in Hitler's horror camps and some imprisoned missionaries found out during World War II. Revelation 13, 16 and 17 suggests how economic pressure would be brought to bear on loyal Christians during the reign of the beast, when no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. This dictator will impose a new legal system on all of his subjects, doubtless based on totalitarian principles, in which the service of the government or the state will be substituted for the absolute standards of God's moral law. All dissent or opposition to the decisions and policies of the little horn will be adjudged treasonable and punishable by death. His program will include a revision of the calendar. This seems to be implied by to change the set times. Now, if the expositor's Bible commentary knows that his program is going to include a change in the calendar, don't you think we understand that and have understood that for quite some long time? A change in the calendar, what does that mean? What are the times there to be changed, brethren? Has anyone ever tried to change the beginning of the months or the years? Has that ever been a big issue or a confrontation about changing the year or the month? With the Sabbath, it's a different story. When you're talking about changing the calendar, it's the Sabbath that becomes an issue at stake here. The Emperor Hadrian in 135 AD made an edict prohibiting Judaism in general and the Sabbath and the holy days in particular. That caused a major movement in God's church for people under pressure from the empire to try to divest themselves of those things that made them appear to be Jews. There was the 70 destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. The Jewish nation regrouped to a degree and revolted again in the 130s. It's called the Bar Kokhba revolt, if I pronounced it correctly. And it infuriated the Romans so badly that they would revolt again, even after the 70 destruction, the 69 and 70 destruction, that they decimated Judea at that time, and they made it illegal to be Jewish in that sense, to observe the Sabbath, to assemble at Jerusalem, to worship in that sense as a Jew. And those Christians who continued to obey God looked conspicuously like Jews in the Roman Empire of that day. And so a major movement was made to try to divest themselves of those things that made them appear to be so. And what are those? The Sabbath and the holy days, not the weeks and such, not the months or that sense, not the years. No, it's the Sabbath and the holy days. And so the church began to step across the line, members of the church, and it was a justification process that then followed as they began to argue as to why these things were now done. And actually the move came first. People began to step across the line, and then they had to figure out afterwards, how can we justify these things? The issue of the resurrection wasn't even an argument back then. That is a modern argument. That is not an ancient argument. And yet the way it is argued, you would think indeed that had been argued from the beginning. It had not. Those are things that simply came along and were added to the process. That process of discrediting the Sabbath day is already beginning to be back in place. They are now producing calendars in Europe, not everywhere, but some of the European calendars, have Sunday now listed as the seventh day of the week. You have to change that to make it obvious, obviously. Some of the airline schedules run on that very schedule as well. Sunday is the seventh day of the week. At this point in time in Europe, it is a secular movement. It is not a religious movement. But the religious connotations are not far behind. We tend to be fairly religious in the United States, and so we tend to assume that our brothers, as we see them historically or otherwise, by government and by heritage and by migration and otherwise, tend to be religious as well. Do you realize that Europe is not a religious body of people? Church attendance throughout Europe is less than 10% of the population. It's a very secular body of people. Church attendance in Germany is 8%. Church attendance in Italy. Italy is very religious, right? Why, they have the Pope there. They have Catholicism. You know how many people in Italy go to church? 3%. It's not a religious body of people. Scandinavia, 2%. It's not as it is sometimes portrayed. I take a weekly news magazine from the German embassy. It's nice to see what some of the German papers, how they report on what happens in the United States or worldwide, and some of the accounts. And I pulled this out, and I got another one this week that basically restated the same thing, but I'll just read you this one. It talks about the Christmas markets. Now, we're talking about a country where 8% of the people go to church, where the government actually collects the monies and dispenses them to the church. The people don't tithe or give money directly to the church. The government collects it for them and gives it to the church. And they split it up between the Lutheran or the Catholic Church there in Germany. But it's a government-controlled matter. The monies of the churches come through the tax system. Christmas markets. This is a non-religious people. Christmas markets are a central fixture of the holiday season in cities and towns throughout Germany. One of the largest and best known of Germany's Christmas markets takes place in Nuremberg, Bavaria, pictured here. And it shows a picture of all these lights and booths and all this festivities taking place. City officials expect at least 2 million out-of-towners to visit this year during the four-week duration of the fair. That is one major city. And this takes place all over. It's not a religious festival. It's a market. It's a celebration. It's a business. It's a way to go out and have a good time. Business hours in Germany are already regulated by the state. Whether you can open or not on Sunday is regulated by the state. The bakeries had to petition a year ago to get permission to open up to sell biscuits or bread or something on Sunday morning, because by state law they cannot. Sunday is already, and has been for quite some time, an enforced day, not a religious day. It's a secular day of where everyone has to close. And so the issue is not initially religious at all. The issue is very secular indeed. But it will become religious very quickly when the time comes, when the time is right. Now, Revelation 20, verse number 4, we see again this martyrdom of God's people. Revelation 20, verse 4 says, I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, who had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Who is going to live and reign with Christ? Just you and me? Just those people who live in the end time when Christ returns? Didn't Paul say that there would be those who would precede us and we would rise to meet Christ in the air? All of the first fruits are going to live and reign with Christ. There are 2,000 years of first fruits, as God has called them, who have been martyred and suffered under this beast power. And the resurrection of the stages of this beast power. And it says here that those who had not worshipped the beast or his image, had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. When I bought the book, and it was a year ago when I sat down and read it the first time, At the very same time, I bought a book on the Inquisition. You might think my reading habits are rather strange. But those are things I need to understand. I need to have perspective on. I need to be able to illustrate. And I sat down and I pulled the book again last night on the Inquisition, and I haven't had a time to really go through that. It's not a priority yet. Besides, it's just as depressing as the other. But it goes through and it describes how many people have died. Now, we're going far beyond the Church of God here. We're going to anybody who opposed the system, the Roman system, the Holy Roman system that existed in their day. And whether it was political or whether it was religious or whether it was convenient or whether it was inconvenient, 50 million people died just through the course of what we call the Middle Ages, which doesn't count the apostles and the church in Armenia and the church there that migrated out of the Caucasus, and it doesn't count our time in the early years before when people died in England and before that. We're just talking about the Middle Ages. 50 million people died. What Hitler did was simply boil that 50 down into a short period of time. What had taken the beast hundreds of years to accomplish in the Middle Ages, Hitler did in three, four years. How long do you think it's going to take to do the last time? With diseases at least able to be loosed as they are, and loosed, with disease at risk in some ways, in a way that we have not experienced yet in our life, at least not since we began to put these measures under control, with the type of mass destruction weapons that exist, with the proliferation of those weapons, with the economy. Has anybody looked at the economy lately? Has anybody looked at the world economy? I want to discuss it in our leadership class today. The world economy, in my opinion, right now, is the number one news item in the world. Across the board, across the internationally, the economy and the effects and the ripple there that, you know, without being able to go into all of that, the beast power is an economic power. And when economic lifestyle and ability and opportunity is threatened on a significant scale, how was it that Hitler rose to power in the first place? What happened before he rose to power? The Depression. It was the Depression that made people desperate enough and foolish enough and self-serving enough to support him and let him rise to authority in Europe. There are some now who are looking at the economies of the world and economies of certain areas, and especially Asia specifically, and are beginning to predict deflation. Not inflation, deflation. Deflation is where you have excess capacity because you've built all these factories and hired all these people and produced all these products to which no one now can afford to continue to consume, and all of a sudden the price has to go the other way. And it's kind of like a whirlpool. It begins to suck itself down. As one person loses, the next loses, and he can't do business with the third, and there begins to be a desperate. Do you think the people today are going to be more tolerant than they were in the Depression? The people in the Depression knew what it was like to have hard times. They knew what it was like to grow your food. They knew what it was like to make your clothes. As a child, I remember growing up, and the rugs we had were rugs that had been cut up from suits and drapes and things that had worn out and were woven together and then braided into a loop, and that was a standard type of rug. Because you use those things. We don't do it anymore. We cast them off. We send them on. We live in a society that is affluent. Our power went out at Camp McKinsey, and you couldn't use the curling irons. You couldn't run the water. You couldn't fix the food. I guess they had gas and burners in the kitchen, but it caused some restraint. You couldn't turn on the lights. You couldn't function the same way. We're looking at some circumstances when this beast rises to power that are going to be incredible and dramatic. And people are going to do drastic and rash things, and there's a lot of people going to die. People are going to die thinking they're serving God. Actually, people are going to die. People are going to kill others thinking they're serving God. John 16. These things have I spoken to you, that you should not be made to stumble. They'll put you out of the synagogues. Yes, the time is coming that whoever kills you will think that he offers God service. You know, the Crusades were a pretense, at least, of doing God service. And when they put somebody on the rack, or when they poured water in them to choke them, or when they burn them, it would take people and literally put their feet up to a fire and spread oil on it and roast their feet, trying to get them saved, as part of trying to get them to leave the heresies behind, which may well have been the truth, and accept something that was indeed true heresy. You know, I don't want to do that. I'd like to pass. I just don't want to do that. I mean, just shoveling my snow to me is rigorous enough. You don't need to take any of those other measures. But those things are going to happen. If it happened once, it will happen again. And it will, again, the 300 years, 400 years, I don't know what the Middle Ages comprise. Hitler accomplished that in 3 or 4. We're going to have that time again. And it's going to be greater than there ever was. And it's going to be like getting in a box with a wild grizzly bear and going to task. And he's going to tear you to shreds. Now, I guess to keep that in perspective, Revelation 14, it isn't necessarily going to be a solution, obviously, to go along with the beast or the system. Because if you do, you're going to have to answer then to God. Revelation 14, verse number 9. Third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast in his image, receives his mark on his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night who worship the beast and his image and whoever receives the mark of his name." Here is the patience of the saints. How do you face those things? I mean, you can either face the beast and confront the beast when it arises and when we see it and when we are faced with that, or you can face God. We're going to give account one way or the other. I think I'll take my chance confronting the beast. Seems like to me God simply has the greater power and program and the truth and the purpose. And all the beast has is vicious and satanic purposes and desires. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. And then I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, "Write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them." You know, there's two kinds of rest. There's the Sabbath rest, which portrays, obviously, as well, salvation. And there's rest from our labor, even in our death. Not always the way we would want to choose, obviously, but it's a rest as well. It says, the patience of the saints are those who keep the commandments of God and have the faith of Jesus. Have the Holy Spirit. Have the truth. Live this life the way that God has called them to. Again, I ask you, what commandments are at stake here? What commandments has anyone ever tried to change? Has anyone ever commanded their people, their churches, to lie and to steal? Oh, I'm not saying some exception. I'm talking about the body of Christian religion. Have they ever been commanded to lie or to steal or to covet or to worship idols? We'd say, oh, worship idols. Well, they don't call them idols. They don't actually use the term, "We want you to worship idols." There is only one command that has consistently been set aside. That's the Sabbath. And that is the command that God's people absolutely do not compromise and will not and continue to keep because God made it holy and made it holy to us. What has happened historically is going to happen again. We need to remain committed to God. We need to remain committed to His Word. We need to be drawing close to God to have that strength and power when that time comes. Another magazine I take anything anybody will send me free almost. Get a lot of coupons. This is the Bible Advocate. There was an article in it entitled "A Reality Check." You see, I can look at Europe and say, well, Germans, they don't go to church. Scandinavians, they don't go to church. Italians, they don't hardly go to church at all. But we do, because we're a religious nation and we have churches on every corner and we speak about religion and we have it on our TV and our radio. And this article says, let's take a reality check. Where are we headed in this country as well in terms of active religious observance? Oh, Christmas is booming. Easter is booming. Halloween is suffering a slow decline, I suppose, in some ways. They'll have to find a way around that. I noticed that they just started, over recent years, observing Halloween in Japan, boost sales of items and celebrations at that time of the year there. They're trying to invest these things in the Japanese culture so that people will go out and celebrate and buy and consume. The writer of this article says, in a given seven-day period of 1991, approximately 44% of the people in the United States attended a religious service. So 1991, 44% of the people, they're going to church. 96, 5 years later, what's the percentage? We're talking right now, the decade we're living through. What do you think has happened? Has it gone up or gone down? And if it's gone down, how much? 5 years, down to 32%. We're talking 91 to 96, right here and now. We're talking 44 to 32% attendance. You think this nation's not on a religious decline, even in terms of just basic moral value and principle? The slide is unbelievable. These things are going to be addressed first in a secular way. Religion will then follow, and people will come back and flock back because of their pocketbooks and because of their jobs and because of the power and the demand that is there set. God shows that some of his people will indeed be martyred in the end time by the beast's power. But lest I leave you with only that scenario, God also shows that some of his people will be protected as well. There are two bodies of people addressed in the scripture. Some are martyred, some are protected. I do not assume that everyone who is martyred is somehow lethargic or somehow not serving God fully or somehow is being given a reality check, but I think maybe many of those will be so. Malachi 3. Let's read some of the scriptures so that we don't leave just as depressed as I go to bed at night when I read these books. Let me read you Malachi 3, verse 16. Then those who feared the Lord spoke to one another, and the Lord listened and heard them. So a book of remembrance was written before him for those who fear the Lord and who meditate on his name. They shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, on the day that I make them my jewels. And I will spare them as a man spares his own son who serves him. Well, you could say, well, what's the context there? Well, the day is coming here, the day, great day of God. This is the end of the book of Malachi, and God is prophetically moving down into the end as well as to those things that would happen and take place. God says, I will spare those my jewels the way a man would spare his own son who serves him. Serves him is the key there. Truly serves God. Revelation 3, one of the other scriptures. I know there's many details in the course of going over the beast power, and there's many questions. There are some questions about the beast power that I cannot actually exactly and perfectly answer. I can't do it. There are things I'm going to have to wait to see come to pass. But in a framework, we see what's coming. And coming indeed it is. Revelation 3 and verse number 7. And the angel of the church of Philadelphia, to the angel write, these things says he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, no one can shut it, for you have little strength. You've kept my word and have not denied my name. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews, who are not, but lie. Indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet, and to know that I have loved you, because you have kept my command. Notice the patience of the saints is the commandments of God, the keeping of the commandments, our service and dedication to God, the faith of Jesus Christ. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that shall come upon the whole earth, to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I come quickly. Hold fast that which you have, that no man can take your crown. God addresses both issues. There is a body of people, says, I'll spare them as my own jewels, as my own precious treasure, and I'll spare them from the hour of trial to come on the whole earth. And there are scriptures that show that all kinds of people over the years have been slaughtered and murdered and killed, and that even down into the end time, some will continue to die as well. God talks about those who are written to in the same article, the same page, the same letter here of Philadelphia, who are listed in some way as God's people, but who are not faithful to God and not responsive to God. And in verse 14, to the angel of the church of the Laodiceans, right? These things says the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. I know your works, and that you're neither hot or cold, and I wish you were hot or cold, because you're lukewarm, neither hot or cold, I will spew you out of my mouth. It's like you take something into your mouth and it is so distasteful that you just spew it out. One time in Pasadena, I was working there at night, and in the office there was a little kitchen area and a refrigerator, and we didn't tend to clean it out very often, and there was a carafe of some, looked like apple juice in there, and it had been sitting there quite some time, and it was late, and I didn't have the light on. I just opened it, and there's light in the fridge, and I poured that carafe out, and I had a cup, and I just poured off into that, and I took a big glug of that, and this big ball of fur landed in my mouth. And I just went all over the copier and the wall and the fridge. I just spewed it out to get that out of my mouth, whatever that was. Something had fermented and compiled itself and came to life, it seemed, right at the top of that and landed in my mouth, and I just couldn't tolerate it there. And it wasn't the kind of thing where you go, oh, let me find a cup. Or I'll walk down the hall and go to the restroom and just put this in the sink. Or you know how sometimes you have a pit from a piece of fruit and you just kind of put it in a little piece of tissue paper, you know, very careful. No, you don't do that. You just spew it out. God says, I'm going to spew you out of my mouth. It's that distasteful. And which means God casts you out there to the beast. God casts you out there to face this world's society on its terms. And it's a horrible sight. It's a terrible thing. Revelation 12, one other verse in this respect. In verse 13, when the dragon, remember the beast in Revelation 12? You remember how there was the dragon who powered and empowered and ruled the beast of Revelation 13 and Revelation 17? Now the dragon saw that he was cast down to the earth. He persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child, and the woman was given wings of a great eagle to fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time, times and a half a time in the presence of the serpent. So there's a group that's nourished for what we understand to be 3.5 years, and in Daniel there's a group that is persecuted and destroyed for 3.5 years. It would appear to be the very same period of time. It just depends on which side of the coin you're on at that moment. So the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood. When the serpent spews it, it's to destroy. And to destroy God's people. It's as if what Satan does is almost to just retch out his wickedness and his viciousness. That he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman. I went through the symbols of woman last week in my sermon, and I think that part at least carried through here in Spokane. And he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Same terms. So there's two groups mentioned here. Now, can I tell you absolutely what the qualifications of one group are versus the other? I cannot. But when I put this together, there's a body of God's people that appear to be dedicated to him all along. There's a body of God's people who appear to have to make that choice to be dedicated to him when it's almost too late. And there are some who are absolutely destroyed the way a grizzly bear destroys its enemy or its anyone who gets in his way and rends him. And as the author spoke of Hitler, he put his claw marks on history in such a way that it will take centuries to dissipate. Many of the wars that we still have today are an outgrowth of what was left over from the destruction and carnage of World War II as well, which was left over from World War I, which is all part of the beast system. And World War III is yet to come. It's going to happen, brethren. We have to look at it in a realistic sense. We have to trust God. We have to be willing to face those things that they come, and not knowing exactly how it will work out for each individually, but God says that we will in the end receive rest. Some are going to have rest because of God's protection from danger. Some may indeed have God's rest because they died in the midst of persecution and strife. The best that we can do, brethren, is always to put God first in our life, to never sacrifice what we believe, to contribute our time and our energy and our congregation's resource to the unity of this church, so that this church can be a refuge for those who want to come in and worship God as we do, so that they would feel welcome and desire to be here with us as something we must do. So that there won't be those who remain outside our own fellowship or church with nowhere to go because they don't feel that we have credibility. They don't feel that we're focused. They don't feel that we're together. They don't feel that we're getting along and showing love and respect to each other. We need to open our doors in such a way that those who will come in will come. And we need to do it not just here and continue to do it here, but we need to do it in United as a whole. It's very, very important. I would hate to think that there are those of my children who are offended at me because of my relationship with them, so that I didn't have a chance to restore and I didn't have a chance to be there to help them when the time came. We are God's children. We are His people. We must open that door to restoration and reconciliation and opportunity so those who wish and God would call will come into our midst and have that opportunity to be strengthened and to indeed be prepared for these incredible times that are yet to come.